Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the arguments today before the Supreme Court in Fisher versus University of Texas, which could spell an end to affirmative action. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, who has argued before the Supreme Court, joins us to discuss whether the conservatives on the court, who seem skeptical of race as a factor in determining college admissions, will strike affirmative action down. Then we will look into the ongoing public health catastrophe from an outbreak of meningitis due to contaminated steroid shots 13,000 people have been exposed to that have caused 12 deaths nationwide. The former Associate Director for Regulatory Affairs at the Office of Human Research Protection within the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Michael Carome, joins us to explain the loophole allowing manufacturers of this deadly tainted product to escape regulation by the FDA. Then finally, the film critic for The New Yorker, David Denby, joins us to discuss the corporatization of our culture, in particular the movies, where mindless, heartless, and pointless effects-laden event movies tailored for 14-year-old boys have replaced movies and stories and characters that adults used to watch. We will discuss David Denby's new book, Do the Movies Have a Future?, and the difficulty of connecting underserved audiences with outstanding independent films that can't find distribution. Joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California, and his books include Interpreting the Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
And today in the Supreme Court, in attendance was Abigail Fisher, the 22-year-old young white Texas woman who brought this case that has reached the Supreme Court that now could end affirmative action and the use of race as a factor in admitting about a quarter of the University of Texas's incoming freshmen. I noticed that retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was in the court. She wrote the majority opinion in the 2003 case that was upheld and that's now being challenged. She, of course, was replaced by Justice Samuel Alito, who's made it very clear that he's very skeptical of racial preferences. With the absence of Justice Elena Kagan, doesn't this look pretty bad for affirmative action, Erwin Chemerinsky?
Well, whether Elena Kagan was there or not, it still comes down to Anthony Kennedy. There are four justices on the current court, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito, who want to overrule that 2003 decision and want to eliminate affirmative action. If Justice Kennedy joins with them, then there's five votes to do it, whether or not Elena Kagan is present. If Justice Kennedy doesn't want to do that, then there won't be five votes, and ultimately, the court will go wherever Anthony Kennedy wants it to go.
Well, Justice Kennedy appeared quite skeptical today on Texas's the University of Texas' defense of their program, saying, "What you're saying is what counts is race above all."
Now, Justice Kennedy didn't ask a lot of questions today. That was the question that he asked that was most pointed, and it was put to the attorney for the University of Texas, Greg Garr. And his answer was that race is just one of many factors in admissions decisions. That's exactly what the Supreme Court in 2003 said was permissible, because the University of Texas admits three-quarters of its class through the so-called top 10% program, the top 10% of each high school get into the University of Texas. For the other 25%, it's a holistic review of the file. In fact, two different scores are calculated for each student. One is an academic index, which is their grades and test scores. The other is a personal achievement index, which is the product of two essays that are graded and seven factors. Race is one of those seven factors. So what Greg Garr said to Justice Kennedy is, race is truly just one in many factors, which is exactly what the Supreme Court prescribed 9 years ago.
So when the Chief Justice, John Roberts, Erwin Chemerinsky, says, questioning the University of Texas, asking them how the university would determine when it had a critical mass of diversity on campus that would allow it to end the program, I guess it gets down to a vision of what America looks like. And I'm curious to know why it is in the first place that this is an issue. Have the opponents of affirmative action really stated what their main problem is, apart from this idea that they are trying to frame it as reverse discrimination?
The opponents of affirmative action argue that the Constitution requires that the government be colorblind in its admissions decision. Chief Justice Rehnquist said this in an opinion in 2007 that was not coincidentally joined by Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. From their perspective, any use of race in admissions is unconstitutional.
Well, but haven't we seen America change? We used to have laws, at least children used to work in mines, women in workhouses. There's so much that's changed over the years, and arguably for the better. I just don't understand what it is that apart from this technical idea, which I suppose makes sense, that justice should be colorblind. After all, there is a blindfold over the symbol of justice. But our society is not colorblind, and it's a wounded society, and it's a society that's trying to heal those wounds. So, I just don't hear the bigger argument here. I hear technical arguments, but I don't hear the heart and soul of it.
Well, I think for them, the heart and soul is it's wrong for a white student to not be admitted to the University of Texas because of her race. It was wrong that Abigail Fisher got denied admission on this basis. Now, of course, that's not entirely accurate. The University of Texas at the trial level said that even if race hadn't been a factor at all, even if Abigail Fisher had gotten a perfect personal achievement score, she still wasn't going to get into the University of Texas. But I think what animates the conservative position, it's this notion that they believe it's wrong that one person will be admitted and another rejected on the basis of race rather than what they call merit. The problem with that argument is that no college or university has ever admitted students solely on the basis of grades or test scores. College universities have always looked to many factors in defining merit. Diversity has always been such a factor. It's always been easier to get into Harvard or Yale if a person's from North Dakota or Montana than if they're from Boston or New York City, because the college recognizes the importance of diversity. At USC, the football players get in with lower grades and test scores because they offer something else in the way of merit. And diversity is part of the merit. Diversity really matters in the classroom.
So if it's wrong for a white student to be not admitted at the University of Texas, is it right that we, for the longest time, up until only the last few decades, that almost everybody in universities in the United States were white?
Well, and to speak of the University of Texas, the University of Texas is a system that historically refused to accept African Americans. In fact, it wasn't until 1950 that the Supreme Court ordered that the University of Texas Law School admit African Americans. The reality is that because of the history of discrimination and current inequalities in the educational system, purely race-blind admissions will lead to a tremendous underrepresentation and often the absence of African American and Latino students.
Well, we've seen this this battle fought here in the University of California, and Erwin Chemerinsky, because you're the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, and one of the regents of the UC system, apparently he's an African American, but he seems to have a personal obsession about this whole issue of getting rid of affirmative action. How has it affected the undermining of affirmative action in the state of in the University of California? Has it changed? Have you noticed the change in terms?
Absolutely. In 1996, California voters adopted Proposition 209. It amended the California Constitution to say that state and local governments in California, in education, contracting, and employment, cannot discriminate or give preference on the basis of race. There was then, at all of the University of California schools, a dramatic decrease in the presence of African American and Latino students. It's come back some as colleges and universities have found ways of coping with this, but there's no doubt that it has had a significant effect in decreasing diversity. And if the Supreme Court in Fisher holds that affirmative action is unconstitutional, we will see exactly that. Let me give you a statistic to make this concrete. In the United States, in 2011, of law students who were admitted, there were only 47 African-American students in the country with an LSAT above 165 and grade point above 3.5. Now, when you look at schools like USC or UCLA or us, you're talking about schools with LSAT medians, you know, 168, 169, grade point medians of above 3.6. If you're talking about schools like Yale and Harvard and Chicago, you're talking about LSAT medians over 170, grade point averages, you know, over 3.8 as a median. Well, think about what that means in terms of the number of African Americans in law school, unless there can be some form of affirmative action.
So surely then somebody should argue to these conservative justices on the Supreme Court the very example of California, what's happened when you take it away.
And the American Bar Association and a friend of the court brief did make many of those arguments. Other of the briefs made that to the Supreme Court. But ultimately, I think it comes down to how much does Justice Kennedy believe that affirmative action should be allowed as a way of gaining diversity? It is an instance where it really comes down to one man on the Supreme Court.
Well, but that's becoming kind of a broken record, isn't it? He's the guy that everybody says. It's almost a one-man court.
At least the health care case came down to John Roberts more than Nancy Kennedy. But yeah. You're right. I mean, most issues on this court, you have a conservative block of Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, a liberal block of Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, not in this case, Kagan. And that leaves Kennedy as the swing justice. Kennedy sides with the conservatives when the court's ideologically divided, but 70% of the time, and with the liberals about 30% of the time. And all the lawyers in this case know that the future of affirmative action hinges on Anthony Kennedy. And a key thing that I think is important for your listeners to know, since Anthony Kennedy came on the Supreme Court in 1987, he has never voted to uphold any affirmative action program in any context. Not schools, not jobs, not contracts. And he's the hope of affirmative action right now.
And just in closing, if Mitt Romney's elected president, he's likely to have the opportunity to perhaps replace Justice Ginsburg, who's the most elderly member of the court, I believe. That would be a completely different court forever, wouldn't it? I mean, there wouldn't be a swing vote. There'd be a solid majority, a conservative majority.
Absolutely. Justice Ginsburg is 79. She'll be 80 in March of next year. She is the oldest of the justices. If Mitt Romney could replace her, it would surely be with another justice like Roberts or Alito. And then there would be five solid conservative votes. And then no longer would Kennedy be the swing justice.
Well, Owen Chemerinsky, we've given our audience something to think about. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Owen Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the managers of a deadly product that's caused the outbreak of meningitis, killing 12 people, escaped oversight.